The Brad Sessmatt Show, broadcasting live.
Off we go into a new week. Thanks for being with us. We will have John Wilner. Wilner has let me know that Michael Crow reached out to him. Michael Crow, president of Arizona State. What possibly could Dr. Michael Crow be talking to John Wilner about, since we have been pounding on Dr. Crow and the lack of attention to the athletic director's chair and just the overall lack of stuff that's been happening around All With Something University through the years? We'll have John Wilner with us. Also, it's a big week. Tomorrow, Dartmouth players are going to vote to unionize. What does that mean? It's a big week where the college football playoff last week said, yeah, let's go to 16. And oh, by the way, we're going to take three from the Big Ten. We're going to take three from the SEC and the rest of you. We're not going to take as much. So I have a lot with John that I want to talk about. David Warlock is going to be with us today. He's from the NCAA. He is part of the media side of the selection committee. So we're less than 2 weeks away, and I have questions. And I want to pull the curtain back a little bit, because all people look at is the last five games, the last 10 games, or wins and losses. No, there's certain kinds of wins and losses. What does a team like GCU do with the two losses they had down in Texas? How does that impact them as an at-large? Very deep in the weeds show today, which I love. I love in the weeds shows. I do. It's not the same old stuff. So that is coming up. Opening comments are brought to you by Desert Financial Credit Union. Desert Financial Credit Union, taking care of you, taking care of your business. As always, that is Desert Financial Credit Union. We do appreciate their support. I don't often make this about me, but I was given this. It's a pretty cool trophy. Got a pose. Here's the pose. No, it's... So this is the Riddle Chapter Leadership Award for the National Football Foundation. I emceed their annual event, Scholar Lunch, on Saturday out at Wild Horse Pass. It was sold out. It was great. I am on the board for the National Football Foundation. Full disclosure, I love what they're all about. I emceed the event, had a great time, and they surprised me with this. I was supposed to announce someone other than, and I announced the president, Braden Dockle, and said, hey, Braden, why don't you come on up here? I hand him the mic, and then all of a sudden, Ron Wolfley pops up on the screen behind me and says, surprise, it's you, Brad, that wins this. Pretty cool trophy. So that was some of my weekend. I watched Caitlin Clark yesterday in the middle of the day in, although God made the DVR for the first half for a reason. I watched Caitlin Clark, and it's 75 degrees out. It's great golf weather, and I'm just glued to watching her destroy Ohio State and her to go about her business and become the all-time scoring leader. And then it turns into debate session. Of course, everything turns into debate. Is she the greatest ever? Well, that's what makes sports so fun. Yeah, except when people start going down the rabbit hole and want to bash on somebody or question somebody or rip somebody, oh, that's what makes sports fun. No, you're going to denigrate. Like Ann Myers Drysdale was not brought up once yesterday when we're talking about the greatest women players of all time. Lynette Woodard was there at the game yesterday. Diana Taurasi should be in the conversation, as should Cheryl Miller, as should Sabrina Ionescu. I mean, I could go down the list. I was the original play-by-play voice of the Mercury back in the day. And people are like, why are you doing women's basketball? Because I have two daughters. I coach them. Girls' sports get nothing. And this was in the late 90s that I was doing the Mercury with Greg Schulte. And now to see it all these years later and to watch her, she is so much fun. Gosh, she's fun. She's good. And they have Gus Johnson doing the game. It's like Fox said, yeah, we're going all in. We're going to bring our A-team announcer, our best of the best, and let him just go at it and do his thing. And he did. It was a lot of fun. Chris Mortensen passed away over the weekend. We had Peter on last week for his goodbye. Peter King retiring, his final column today. I know Peter is very close to Chris. I've not read Peter's final column as of yet, although I saw that he mentioned Chris in there. I have to wonder if Peter's decision to step away had anything to do with his close friend, Chris Mortensen. Somewhere along the line of, you only get one shot at this rodeo, you only get one bite at the apple. And Chris had valiantly fought cancer. We have had Chris Mortensen on the show. We had him on a handful of times when he would go to the combine. I can't say that I knew him as others. I just know that when he popped up on the screen, and I'm always cognizant of people's time, that it was, okay, I have 5 minutes, and I felt bad if I went 6 or 7, and he'd be fine if we went 9 or 10 or 11. He was that good. And of course, the ultimate insider in breaking down knowledge, dropping knowledge. Here's what's going on behind the scenes. You know, Andy Katz was the first on the college basketball scene. Woj came along in basketball. Peter's been there in football. It has given way to several others whose careers have been nothing more than insiders, which is great. Shams now. It's fine. But I think if you don't talk about Chris Mortensen, you're not doing the job of insider the service. If I'm teaching at Cronkite today, if I'm doing a lecture today, it is, look, here's somebody that you need to know blaze the trail. And by the way, you can do this if you want to get into media and you can make a career out of it. And that's what he did. And he handled himself very, very well. The Suns were getting booed last night. I sat here last night, I was working on show stuff, and I hear boos raining down on the Suns. Well, let's see, Devin Booker rolled his ankle. He didn't play. The mere fact of it is, as they lost Oklahoma City, the Suns looked old. The Suns, in my opinion, looked old. People don't want to hear that. They just want go Suns and all that stuff. It's no, when you run into a team that's just younger and fresher, and they've got a really, really good group of young players that are star players, and you just see them, and they have the number one seed right now. I don't know if they'll be able to hang on to it. I said here a couple weeks ago, I doubt they would be able to. After watching them last night, I could be dead flat wrong. They are a handful. And they gave the Suns fits last night. And they pretty much controlled the game. You know, the final score was an 8-point margin, but it felt much bigger than that as the night went along. That's a bad loss for the Suns. If they are a team that is truly going to start doing this, yeah, it's March. I take this stuff a little more serious. I'll take it very serious in about 3 weeks. But now it's like, that's concerning. So boos from Phoenix Suns fans? Wow. The Diamondbacks made an interesting signing over the weekend. Elvis Andrus signed. They have a shortstop, Perdomo. They have a young shortstop in the system. They signed Andrus as a backup. It's just an interesting move. It kind of made me tilt my head, like, why that spot? You know, how about another pitcher? Another pitcher. All right, that is what is on my mind, brought to you by Desert Financial Credit Union. We do appreciate their support. Up next, it's John Wilner. All things college football with John, as we do every week. John was announced last week as a finalist for a national award. I'll let him tell you about that. And then we will go down the college basketball rabbit hole with David Warlock from the NCAA on March Madness. And does GCU get off of the – did they get in the tournament if they don't win in Vegas next week after stumbling in Texas? And does U of A need to win out to be a number one seed? We'll get into all that with David Warlock too, all straight ahead. Great to have John Wilner, as always, Mondays with John Wilner Hotline. You can follow his content on the website, of course, over on X, as we like to call it, or they like to call it now, at Wilner Hotline. John has been nominated for a national honor that is like, what? You've not been honored yet as the best at what you do? So I'm going to have you talk about yourself for a moment to start this segment out.
Oh, God.
Take it away. Yeah, I know. People hate talking about themselves.
Oh, man.
So you get honored. I put it on the site. You have to talk about it.
I appreciate you doing that and all your support. I love our partnership. Yeah, the Hotline coverage got nominated, the Associated Press sports editors. For top 10, Hotline was named top 10, beat writer. And they'll pick the top 10 in, I think in a month or two, but you know, just being in the top 10 with great, you know, fantastic, talented peers, is very much an honor.
Look at you. Okay. So I'm going to go down this path because people have been asking me,
What is going to happen with Wilner Hotline when the Pac-12 ceases, or doesn't cease, goes to two? And I've said, John's got plans. Can you share any of those plans yet? Or are you going to keep it still a shrouded mystery?
No. Well, I mean, it's evolving. I think that we'll rename it. The leaders in the clubhouse are either College Hotline, which was the original name of my site until about 2018. And back then, under College Hotline, is when we first started writing about all the problems under Larry Scott. Or we'll just go with Wilner Hotline, which is, you know, my ex handle and kind of what the brand is known as these days. So it'll be pretty simple name change. And we're just going to keep covering all the stuff that's going on. It doesn't matter if the teams are playing under the banner of the Pac-12. It's everything is really the same. They're playing for championships. They're recruiting. They're dealing with all the NCAA issues. They're trying to get into the playoff. Nothing changes. So we'll be writing about ASU and Arizona for your readers and BYU and Utah and how all those four schools are doing in the Big 12. We'd be writing about the Big 10. We're covering the Pac-2 still, ACC. It really doesn't change much.
I love how you say back when we were covering all the problems under Larry Scott. That's all there's been is problems with these commissioners.
The thing is, that's true. But, you know, back in Larry Scott's first 3 or 4 years, so 2009 to 2012 or so, he was lauded throughout the industry as being an innovator and setting the Pac-12 up for success, creating the Pac-12. But then we started writing about 2014 under the College Hotline. I started writing about this growing revenue disparity between the Pac-12 and the other conferences and the management issues and the fact that the presidents, including Michael Crow, had checked out and were letting Scott spend amok. And so we were writing about that stuff for years and then switched the name to the Pac-12 Hotline late last decade. So, you know, nothing's changing for us with the schools switching, with our name switching. You and I are still going to be here every Monday talking about these huge issues that affect each of the schools, what's going on the field, off the field, and what the next evolution of college football is going to be. Because as we've talked about, it's going to change drastically in the next 5 to 7 years, right? The sport is going to be unrecognizable by 2030, and we will be chronicling the whole thing.
Now, I have some of those changes to get to in a minute. John Wilner with us, Wilner Hotline. You can follow all of his content over on X and other platforms. He joins us every Monday and on TV shows and all that. So you mentioned Michael Crow. We have sat here for the last few years and just tarred and feathered him weekly, it feels like, to the point where it's like low-hanging fruit content if we wanted to do it. But we're talking off air. He reached out to you, and do you care to share what Dr. Crow said to you, John?
Well, yeah, I wrote about the differences with Arizona and ASU both conducting AD searches at the same time. This was a few weeks ago before Arizona hired Desiree Reed-Francois. And I kind of contrasted the two situations, and Crow reached out to me with an explanation for why ASU is taking so long, right? Because Ray Anderson announced he was stepping down, was early mid-November, I think,
yep,
right?
It was.
And they haven't really done much. And so he explained why they have not hired an athletic director. It took Arizona 1 month. ASU has been going on, 4 months? And there's no sign of somebody being hired. So he explained that it's kind of a holistic view of how ASU athletics fits into the broader scope of the university. It won't be a surprising, in that regard, it's probably not surprising for ASU fans who feel like, you know, he's not doing enough for athletics. But so I will be writing about that tomorrow, and it'll be on the website. Mm-hmm. All ASU fans should check out the site, and you guys will have it.
That is
very Michael Crow.
Very Michael.
And the thing is, and we got to be fair, right? He's done phenomenal things for the university.
Yes,
but at the same time,
no.
Right? It's an incredible dichotomy in terms of how things have gone for ASU, the university, and ASU athletics.
I'm very much looking forward to that. John Wilner with us. Okay, so we have a lot to get to just on the business side of sports. There's one topic I want to lead into before we get over to the busyness of this week and what's going to happen in terms of employees and athletes on that. That's Caitlin Clark. So, John, when you first started writing, when was it?
When did I first start writing about college sports? I mean, it's been decades, right? Yeah. It was after the NCAA began to recognize women's basketball. But, you know, back in the after the Cheryl Miller era. So late, you know, early 90s.
So women's basketball, and you mentioned Cheryl Miller, and I'll go back to Annie Myers Drysdale, who lives in the Valley, and I see Annie all the time, and we see what's going on with Caitlin Clark, and I was the original play-by-play voice of the Phoenix Mercury, so I love women's basketball. I love women's sports. I have two daughters. I see girls' flag football now becoming scholarship-driven in colleges. Grand Canyon signing a quarterback down here. It's crazy, but so all that to say, you see the Caitlin Clark coverage. Some of it I felt like early was, look at how inclusive we are. We're the media company that's paying attention, which was nonsense. Now everybody and their brother, like Gus Johnson, is doing Caitlin Clark's game yesterday. And so I'm just curious your view of how women's sports has evolved and a face like Caitlin Clark and what it is doing.
Yeah, I've been thinking about the Clark situation. I mean, is it really that much different than what Sabrina Ionescu was receiving in terms of media coverage? What was that, 4 or 5 years ago? I mean, she was a huge story. Mm-hmm. You know, LeBron and Nike and all that. I feel like, you know, Clark is maybe a half step above that. Certainly she's a phenom and she's generating a ton of attention for the sport. But to me, what Sabrina did kind of set the platform here for Clark to maybe take it one step higher. So, but women's college basketball is thriving. You know, a lot of women's softball is too, right? We are certainly seeing an evolution in the popularity of these sports. And it's interesting because the NCAA has had a whole lot of problems kind of figuring out how women's sports fits into their business model and their entire approach, right? Remember all the controversy a few years ago when the women's tournament didn't have the same
They had the one bench and a coolers or lunch, right?
Yeah. So the NCAA has struggled to kind of keep up with the growing popularity, and certainly the TV deal for the women's tournament was undervalued. But yeah, it's fantastic. And look, Title IX, which laid the groundwork for all of this 52 years ago, has been phenomenal for women's sports. Absolutely phenomenal. It's interesting when you think of Title IX in the grand scheme of men's sports, however, and what it's done to men's sports and what it's forced athletic departments to do in order to be in compliance. But look, women's basketball has never been more popular. It's fantastic.
It's a lot of fun to watch. I find myself on a Sunday afternoon in Arizona where it's 75 degrees watching Caitlin Clark indoors saying, this is Steph Curry.
Steph Curry, yeah, sure.
Yeah. And she is her own too. So it's not just like, oh, I'm comparing to guys. Just when I watch her game, it's wow.
She did flop, though. I got to say, she did flop.
She's flopping. Of course.
And that post-game celebration where she got, Ronaldo would have been proud of that flop, yes.
There you go. Dartmouth is in the news cycle. Yep. This is a week where, and when people tell me what they love about our segment is we get way into the weeds. We're not afraid to get into the weeds. We are really going to get into the weeds right now because this is a week that will be game-changing for the employee-employer relationship and what college athletes will look like, we believe, in the future. And it involves Dartmouth. This is not new. Northwestern tried this to unionize. John, what do we expect this week? It's supposed to be tomorrow. But what do we expect from Dartmouth that fans will be like, what? Why?
Well, yeah, players are going to vote on unionization. And it would be the first athletes union in college sports, right? The National Labor Relations Board has paved the way for the Dartmouth players to unionize. And it's interesting because the Ivy League, which is like the closest thing to what the NCAA wants amateurism to be, mm-hmm. is going to have the first labor union in college sports. But I will say that there's also an NLRB issue going on with USC. Right. And I don't know that we've talked about it. It's now 2 years, I think 2.5 years since the complaint was filed. But the NLRB in LA has filed a complaint against USC, the Pac-12, and the NCAA together as a three-pronged entity. That, to me, is actually more important than what's going on with Dartmouth. And here's the reason. The NLRB has jurisdiction over private universities, right? That's why there was the issue with Northwestern a few years ago. Dartmouth is private, right? So USC is also private. But here's what's going on. They have tied USC to the Pac-12 and the NCAA in an attempt to make USC athletes joint employees of not only the Pac-12, but also the NCAA. The NCAA has public schools. So the NLRB is looking at this complaint with USC as a way to essentially get public university athletes under its umbrella so that unionization could occur not just with private schools, but also with public schools and make it national. So that's why they tied USC's USC's athletes to the Pac-12 and to the NCAA. So in that regard, because of the potential for it to be a national issue, national unionization, the USC Pac-12 NCAA deal is actually more significant than the Dartmouth unionization movement.
Okay, and so for someone watching right now, they're going to say, I don't care. I just know my quarterback needs to throw it to my wide receiver.
That's right. That's right.
My guard needs to go score 25 points a game. Why should I care about this?
Well, that's why when I said before that, you know, the hotline is going to continue writing about all the issues and we're going to keep talking about all the issues because they're all interrelated. They all these things on the legal front are going to impact the schools and the competitive, what we see competitively, the conferences they're in, the money they're making. So the reason it matters is if the students are deemed employees, right, they're going to get salaries directly from the schools. And the schools are going to have to determine, one, do they want to do that, right? Does a Stanford want to be paying its players as employees? Does Rice, does Northwestern and Duke and all the academic-oriented schools, they'll have to decide. And the other schools are going to have to find the money, because it's going to be really expensive. And so is ASU going to start paying, you know, football players 50 grand because they have collectively bargained a deal? And if they do, then what happens to the Olympic sports, right? Because there's only so much money. And a lot of people fear that if athletes are deemed employees and they collectively bargain, that that's going to result in Olympic sports getting eliminated because the schools don't have enough money.
Okay, so then wrap the NIL story around it that we discussed last week with what happened in Tennessee, because, let's just say this is the dollar figure, but Booster could come along, Coach could come along, anybody could come along and say, well, no, you deserve, or we're going to pay you X amount more so you don't go to Texas or you don't go to Ohio State. Wrap that in on this.
Well, we don't know how the NIL world is going to evolve if athletes are deemed employees and collectively bargained. NIL could go away. The other piece is the NCAA is trying to get NIL moved in-house so that the universities are doing the NIL contracts with the employees, getting rid of the collectives. The NCAA does not like the collectives. You know, it's crazy. They started off by saying, all right, we're going to do NIL, but the schools can't have anything to do with it. Schools can't touch NIL. It has to all be third-party entities that were, you know, not affiliated with the schools. And now the NCAA is saying, no, you know what? The third party entities, the collectives, that's bad. The schools need to be in charge of NIL. So they've completely reversed their position, which it typifies the NCAA and its complete failure to properly govern its stakeholders. And I would add, with all this stuff, all the schools suing, Tennessee suing, you know, all these changes, the schools are the NCAA. They set up the rules. Tennessee was part of setting up the rules that Tennessee then takes to court to fight. You know, it's bananas.
How do you think this is going to play out?
I think that we're going to get to the point where there's a Super League, where there's, you know, 24, 32 teams that are playing football at a different level with a different governing structure, different competitive platform. different media deal than everybody else. Because okay. I just think
let me jump in on that.
Yeah.
We're already starting that with the college football playoff now this last week, saying, you know what? Let's just expand. What are we doing? Right. Hey, why we're the Big Ten and we're the SEC. We want three each.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, no, that happened last week, and it's good you brought that up because it's definitely worth talking about. Not only are they saying we want three and the ACC and Big 12 can get two, but they have the gall to say we want the first two seeds, right? They're going to set it up 14-team playoff and it'll be like the NFL deal, right, where the top seed in each conference gets a bye. Well, the way they're going to set up the NCAA, 14 teams, the top two seeds will get a bye, right? So you'd have 12 teams playing opening round games, six winners advance, then the top two seeds come in and they play the round of eight. So the SEC and the Big Ten are saying, you know what? We want those top two seeds guaranteed for our champions, regardless of the record. So you could have a three-loss SEC champ getting a bye over undefeated Florida State. It's crazy. But
because they believe that we bring more to the table than just what the W and the L is.
Yes, they
are.
And
the brand name, the TV revenue, because we are Alabama and we lost a couple of games. We played some cupcakes. Doesn't matter during the regular season. We get the number one seed because we bring all this revenue to you. Right?
Yes. Oh, yeah. And they do. They have, I mean, if you tally up the 15 biggest brands in college football, 12 of them are in the SEC and Big Ten, right? All of them except for Notre Dame, Florida State, and Clemson. So it shows you, you know, how much power they think they have. And to me, the three, and I'm writing about this today. In fact, it'll be on your site by lunchtime, hopefully. I think that the 3-3-2-2 deal where the SEC and Big Ten each get three automatic bids in a 14-team playoff and the ACC and Big 12 get two, I think that's actually a good deal for the Big 12 and ACC. If I'm Arizona and Arizona State and BYU and Utah and Colorado, I would be pushing the Big 12 to take that deal. You get two guaranteed berths, that is better than the alternative because the alternative is you only get one guaranteed berth or there are no guaranteed berths, in which case the SEC and the Big Ten could each take four or five, right? So I actually think the Big 12 and ACC should take that deal. They should not accept a situation where the Big Ten and SEC get the first two seeds guaranteed. That is preposterous.
Okay, but John, so if they're already pushing, this goes back to what we just talked about, Super Conference. You and I have had this discussion before, but now I'm starting to see, like, off in the distance, this big wave is coming, and by the time we get to, let's just say they expand the playoff, they're going to expand it again, and then they're going to have a cutoff
again
by about 2027, 2030. It's, yeah, you know what? We're just going to have 50, and the rest of you can go pound sand. That's basically where I see it going from
all. I don't know if it'll – well, that could be. And in that case, you know, you're kind of keeping the current structure. I'm just thinking we could get to a situation where the top 24 or 32 football schools create their own league, right? And they're backed by private equity or ESPN and Fox. You know, they televise. It's an entirely different deal, right? The college football is an inefficient market because you have each conference negotiating their own TV deal, right? If the top 32 schools got together and negotiated a TV deal or 24 schools, they'd get more money per school, right? And there is not an unlimited supply of money coming in from Fox and ESPN, right? They're going to eventually say, all right, Big Ten, we're paying you $1 billion a year, and that's it. And Ohio State and Michigan, you want
– John, it's you're right, but then what you're saying is we're not going to show Indiana football. Goodbye. We're not going to show Minnesota football. Goodbye. There's going to be these programs that they may be great in basketball and have great history, tradition, and heritage, but there's not a chance that in prime time they're going to show Indiana against Washington. This is not going to happen.
They're not going to show Arizona and Arizona State either.
No.
They're not going to show the Arizona schools either.
Yes. No,
they're going to be streaming, right? or FS1 or something like that, because there's only so much money left for the networks, right? Cable, cord cutting, all that stuff. So they're going to say, all right, we're paying you $1 billion. And then here's what's going to happen. Ohio State, Michigan, and Penn State, they're going to say, well, we want more. Yes. And the only way we're going to get more is if we create our own league, right? So that's essentially, I think, what's going to end up happening. To me, I see two inflection points. One is in the next 2 years, right? And it would start with Florida State, you know, winning its court case against the ACC and that conference breaking apart. Or we get through this tumultuous period with the NIL and the transfer portal and the athletes becoming employees and the ACC deal. We get through it all, and then the Big Ten comes back to the negotiating table in 2029 to do a new deal, and Fox says, you know what, you're not going to get a whole lot more money, and Ohio State and Michigan say, okay, well, then we're going to form our own league, and come on, Alabama and Georgia and Notre Dame, and there
Texas.
We go.
Yeah. No,
Texas, all that.
But to try to make it the NFL model, I think that's where it needs to be. But there's, you know, it's something we've talked about, that there's no commissioner in place in order to do that. And John, just so we're clear, and you know this, we've had tumultuous off seasons now 3 years in a row. So to think that all of a sudden everything is just going to smooth itself out from Texas, Oklahoma to UCLA and USC to this, I just don't see where we're going to have a peaceful, easy feeling, to borrow a line from a great song.
It's going to be rough. You know, and that's, again, getting back to our original part. That's what the hotline is for, right? Is to help people understand what is going on with all this stuff. And that's what we do. And you have to, I mean, we're kind of like a guide for fans to figure out, here's what's happening. Here's how, you know, this stuff affects your school and your school's future and your ability to pay your coach and your ability to recruit your quarterback and the conference you're in, the schedule you form, the TV network that you're on. All that stuff is being affected. And that's our job, right? Is to explain to people what it all means, you know, arm in arm, get through to the next evolution here with your listeners and your audience.
Yeah. And then I got to put my gaming app down, how I can bet on the
team. Oh boy.
Part of it. And
that's another show. That's like a 10 part series, right? Because eventually you're going to be able to click on whether it's, you know, the ASU Oklahoma State game, or it's the Bills against the Bengals. You're going to tune in on your 50 inch, 60 inch, 70 inch screen, and you're going to flick on Amazon or Apple. And half the screen is going to be the game. The other half the screen is going to be your prop bets and your fantasy team. And it's all going to be synced. And you're going to click a button for $50 that the next play is a run. Or you're going to click a button, how did my quarterback just do today? It's all going to be right there. And that's going to change everything again.
We just did 25 really good minutes, and I could keep John for another hour. But hey, by the way, John does this with John Canzano, who's very good at what he does as well. They do the Wilner Canzano podcast. They have it in reverse order. They just don't know who's the star. That's me. All right. Get out of here. Good stuff as always.
Thanks so much, Brad.
There's John Wilner, and we're back with more after this timeout. Thanks again to John Wilner for being with us for a few minutes. We have John on every week. Good to chop it up with him. And now we have a new face, a new name. David Warlock is with us for a couple of minutes from the NCAA, Director of Media Coordination. David came onto my radar through the great Andy Bagnato. There's not much about Andy that I will ever say, wow, he really missed it here. But he said, you really have to have David on to talk about the NCAAs and March Madness and what's going to be at Glendale in April. Of course, we will be all over that, traveling up to Vegas next week for the WAC tournament with GCU, and of course the Pac-12 as well. David, it's good to see you. Thanks for coming on board.
Hey, thanks for having me, Brad. Always good to be with any of the media from our host cities, especially for the Final Four. Looking forward to a great event next month.
Okay, so 2 weeks from yesterday, it's all going to be laid out there. And I'll get into U of A and I'll get into GCU in a minute. I was part of an exercise that David and his team put together of going through conferences, and it was pretty intense and pretty exhaustive. So I guess what I'm wondering is, pulling the curtain back, the people that are really in this process, are their lives over with right now, the next 2 weeks, trying to figure this all out?
Yeah, especially now. I mean, now it's real. Actually, I was in Chapel Hill this weekend and with Bubba Cunningham, who's the AD in North Carolina and the vice chair this year, will be the chair for 24-25. And you just get a sense from talking to him and talking with a couple other community members this morning that it's starting to get real. It's a process that begins from the first day of the season, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. The communication with all the conferences and that conference monitoring program you just mentioned begins in earnest in, you know, late December. And then it's weekly once we, you know, get through the holidays. And, you know, it's a lot of work. And you have to keep in mind, these are commissioners and ADs. And so they have, you know, pretty busy full-time jobs. So to add this to their plates is you know, like giving them a second full-time job. And, you know, our job as a staff is to make have all the resources available to make their decisions here in, you know, next week when we get started a week from Wednesday.
David, what is the most difficult seed to come across? Is it finding the fours or the nines or the 16s? You don't know until the day of or the day before because conference tournaments in all likelihood. The ones, there's like six or seven that you look at. We're this close to the brackets being unveiled. Can you give the fans an idea of like where we've got to focus in on getting the 4 versus 12, or, you know, those types of seedings correct? 5-12, I should say. But to get
I think the sweet spot typically is in that 11-12 range, because that's where a lot of attention's placed, because there's no mystery surrounding Purdue's inclusion in the tournament, for example. Arizona, I'm not giving away state secrets, Arizona will be in the tournament this year. So there is a lot of attention placed there in those last teams that did get in, as well as the teams that just missed out in getting in. Those typically fall in the 11-12 line. So they draw attention because, you know, there's, especially the bracketology community really has blown up. So there's people everywhere, mm-hmm. Especially online, trying to guess what the committee is going to do. And we're transparent with the information that's out there and what the committee uses. And so I think people can make reasonable guesses in terms of who's going to get in and even seeding in many cases. And so a lot of people will look to that because those are the teams that will, you know, draw a lot of attention on Selection Sunday night in terms of who didn't get in, why they didn't get in, and as well as those who did. And, you know, quite honestly, those are good basketball teams. There's been, you know, a couple of examples of teams that have been among the last teams to make the field to make deep runs. Obviously, VCU and UCLA are prominent examples of that, having, you know, advanced from first four to the final four. But there's been a few other teams that have, you know, made runs into the second round, into the Sweet 16.
Yeah, even last year with San Diego State, who we saw over here against Grand Canyon. And I want to get over to that because Grand Canyon, before they went to Texas last week and lost a couple of games, I was having the discussion and debate, even had Coach Drew on and others, that, okay, every year I go to Vegas and I go over to the Orleans and I see if GCU is going to win because that's the only way they're going to get in. This year, I looked at it and said, well, okay, they beat San Diego State. They had a tough, close loss to South Carolina. Who's had a pretty good season. Are they in a spot now, David, where they've got to still win because they had their two hiccups, or are they somebody that is around that 11, 12, 13 because they've done enough? I think if it's one and done, all or nothing for them, that'd be really hard, a team that's closing in on 30 victories.
Yeah, I would say, you know, keep in mind, I don't get a vote in the room.
Sure.
But I am privy to conversations. And, you know, I'd be surprised, quite honestly, if Grand Canyon, if they did slip up in the WAC tournament, that they weren't at least considered for a possible at-large spot and inclusion into this year's field. I was actually at the San Diego State game. Just an unbelievable experience just being there. The atmosphere before, during, and after the game was very unique in a very good way. But more importantly, it was just an outstanding basketball game between two quality teams. Yeah, sure, they had the losses I think it was 2 losses in 3 nights, if my memory's right. The Abilene Christian, let's face it, it's, Abilene Christian's a team that's not in the top 200 of the net, so it's not a great loss, but it also came 2 nights after the loss, if my memory's right, to Tarleton. And Tarleton's a good basketball team. I mean, that's a team that's probably 125 range of the net. And, it's a good team. It may not have the name appeal as some of the teams that are more mainstream. I'm a Division II guy. I can remember my alma mater playing Tarleton State in Division II games all the time. So I know a lot of people don't, know Tarleton's name. But Tarleton's a good basketball team. That's not a quote-unquote bad loss for Grand Canyon. So what they've done in the non-conference, including the win over San Diego State that we mentioned, beating a good San Francisco team, I think that was on a neutral court. They beat Louisiana Tech, who's having a good season. And like you mentioned, the South Carolina game, which was a competitive game early in the year. So it's a good basketball team. And I think they'll be considered for inclusion if they don't get the automatic qualifier with the WAC championship.
When we see the tournament being unveiled and they talk about net, this audience, we're 2 weeks out, the net of GCU, I don't have it in front of me today, but what is the net range to say this is an at-large versus they got to win their conference tournament in order to get in? Is there if you're in the 40s, I remember GCU was there at one point. If you're in your 40s or 50s, Brad, you're in pretty good shape. If you're 55, is there a range for the net, David?
Yeah, there's no set defined range. I can tell you, that we've had teams in the net era, which goes back to 2018-19, that have been in the 30s. That did not get an at-large bid, as high as 33 one year. Last year, North Texas, I think, was 38. Didn't quite get in. Of course, they went on to win that NIT, so that was a quality basketball team that just didn't get voted in. On the other side of things, last year, Arizona State and Pittsburgh were in the mid to upper 60s in the net on Selection Sunday and got in. And then the year before that, Rutgers was 77 on Selection Sunday and got in. So it's a lot more than your net ranking. In fact, I always tell people your net ranking is probably not as important as your opponent's net ranking, because when people hear about quad one wins, it's not about your net ranking. It's about where your opponents are. So quad four losses have to do with who your opponents are ranked in the net. And then that's just one of the metrics that's used. I think there are about 55 in the net this morning. They're a little bit better, not much difference in some of the results metrics, but those are important, being top 50, in that range for strength of record, for example. Tells the committee that it's a good basketball team. Their predictives are about the same. They're pretty consistent with their metrics. They have a good road record, which is important. And, quite honestly, they just have very few losses. I think 4 losses now. It's a good basketball team. Any way you cut it, committee doesn't use the eye test, but they look at a lot of data, and the data points to a team, that's certainly worthy of possible inclusion as an at-large team if they don't get in as the automatic qualifier. And if they do get in one way or the other, it's going to be a team that gives someone fits in the first round.
No, I agree with you on that. One other question about GCU. Are there conversations, as far as you can share with us, behind the room specifically about what do we do with Grand Canyon University because of the season that they've had? Are those conversations going on in rooms?
Yeah, I mean, yes, those conversations will take place. I mean, the committee's had a couple of calls already, and I can't disclose what was shared or anything like that. But year after year, teams like that, last year off the top of my head, Oral Roberts, College of Charleston, very similar type seasons. And the committee has to discuss beforehand, will this team be an at-large possibility if they don't win their respective leagues? Now, both Charleston and Oral Roberts ended up winning their tournament, so the whole thing became moot from the standpoint that there was – no vote that had to take place whether or not to include them as an at-large. In fact, those two teams won their tournament before the committee's meeting even began. Mm. So there was, they didn't even have to get in on, you know, what we call the initial ballot. So there's been a long history of teams that come from conferences that more years than not are one bid leagues. But being in a conference like that doesn't preclude anyone from having the opportunity to get an at-large bid. You know, should they put together a strong resume and then, you know, get tripped up in the conference tournament.
Yeah, as you said off the top of the interview, stuff that starts the opening day of the tournament, the South Carolina and San Diego State games were months ago, and now they are factored in and all this. Before I get you out of here, David Warlock with us for a couple of minutes with the NCAA Director of Media Coordination. March Madness, of course, is coming. The tournament is in Glendale. It's great to have it here once again. We are proud to be a host city and to be all involved in the tournament. Arizona, now they've got to go to USC and UCLA. The whole debate is, are they going to be a one seed? It looks like they're one seed. People automatically say, well, they have to have a team out west. I don't know if I buy into that, but that's the reason U of A could be on the number one line. What do you make out of U of A, big picture that you can share from the committee's view?
Yeah, obviously, you know, one of the country's best teams. They have been all year. Coach Lloyd has an outstanding team. You look at them any way you cut it, whether you're just watching them play, but using all the metrics, how efficient they are. You know, they win games on the road. They've played a very strong schedule, very, you know, even stronger non-conference strength of schedule. And they've beaten teams like Alabama and Michigan State. And they won at Duke, which, you know, not many teams have done that over the years, going into Cameron and winning. But just an outstanding team. In terms of your question about being a one seed, I mean, that is not guaranteed just because we need a team in the West region, and Arizona, as things stand today, certainly seem to be the top team from the Pacific time zone, or will eventually be Pacific time zone, maybe a few more days. But the bottom line is, you know, if Arizona falls to the number two line, and UConn, for example, is the fourth number one, and everyone and the other regions are taken, UConn would be the number one in the West. I mean, there's no geographic limitations to that. So it could fall that way. You know, that Arizona's a one seed and placed in the Los Angeles regional. But it's nothing the committee is locked into doing. If four West Coast teams are the number one seeds, then obviously someone's going Midwest, someone's going East, and then the opposite, if it's East Coast teams, you know, someone eventually is going to go West as the one seed in that region.
One other question, and that is, this really for U of A is about seeding now. They have the two games out in LA, and then they have the Pac-12 tournament. Assuming that they run the table, they're going to be in that discussion for a number one seed, just my view. If they trip up, does the conversation, whether it's U of A or any other team that's in this spot, does the conversation become ramped up? And if they trip up twice, does it become ramped up even more? Or in the ones and twos, the highest seeds, it is really how you've played the whole year. It's not how you finish. There's this, it's not how you start, it's how you finish view. And then there's like, no, there's the whole body of work. I think fans may get too caught up in what the final 2 weeks look like, or the final 10 games look like, versus the start of the season. Where do you come down on that? Where's the committee come down on that?
Yeah, Brad, it's a great question, because it's a misconception that the committee uses last 10 games or last 12 games. Right. It used to be that way. But the committee wants to focus on the full body of work. The entire season counts. Now, you'll take into consideration missing players, missing coaches, whether just coaches ill or suspended, you know, and so all that comes into play. But at the end of the day, games in November count. And I know from watching some, you know, Pac-12 games recently, I know Sean Farnham's been, you know, vocal about, you know, including that, and the committee will, you know, could potentially discuss that this summer in terms of having that as a resource or criteria, if you will, but it won't be used this year. They won't adjust those criteria mid-season. I don't know of any plans to bring that up again. But you know, nothing would be off the table. But in terms of this year, now it's the full body of work. If Arizona were to stumble this weekend, you know, sure, it could potentially hurt, you know, their chances, but then they have the Pac-12 tournament to, you know, to rebound. And then you have to see what everyone else is doing. At the end of the day, those would be two quadrant two losses. So they're not damning, and it doesn't overshadow the wins I mentioned before, you know, both, you know, in the non-conference. And I think they beat Wisconsin in there and Belmont, some good wins. And then obviously what they've done in the Pac-12 is, you know, is stellar as well. So, yeah, I think Arizona is going to be in that discussion. And you know, if they do slip up this weekend with two more losses, yes, it'll hurt their chances at a one seed, but it doesn't eliminate them by any stretch.
You must be in a tough spot within like your friend groups, because there's got to be dudes that are like, so what'd you think about the Belmont game last night? So what'd you think about the, you know, this game and that game? And then your morning is probably, this happened last night in the MEAC. This happened in the Sun Belt, right? This is that your world right now, David? Am I right in your wheelhouse?
You are. That's you know, I literally watch basketball every night from November to March. This past Saturday, being in Chapel Hill and having my son with me, I felt anxious that I wasn't in front of the TV watching all these games. And then sure enough, we go into the Dean Smith Center and they had Marquette, Creighton, Arkansas, Kentucky, and another game, you know, on the big screen. It was like, oh, this is perfect. I'm able to watch these games. But I am doing a lot of notes and research, you know, just about every day and every night, watching games as much as I can, keeping track of everything that's going on, with a lot of help, you know, from, you know, not only my colleagues on staff, but the conference offices as well, supply a lot of information, especially related to, you know, missing players, missing coaches, things of that nature. So it's not a solo effort by any stretch of the imagination, but yeah, it is definitely my world. It's something I dreamt about as a kid. So I don't even consider it work. It's something I enjoy doing very much.
That's awesome. If you ever need an assistant, I'm around. If they ever expand, I'm around. If they're ever, I'm a hoopaholic, as I like to say, a hoop junkie. And I think this stuff is great. I appreciate your time and insights, David. Thanks.
Glad to be with you, Brian.
David Warlock for the NCAA Director of Media Coordination, and we're back with more after this timeout.